Welcome to the Uncovered Podcast, where we take a deeper look into the ideas, companies, and entrepreneurs that are creating the future and uncover the stories you haven't heard. Uncovered is presented by PJC, an early stage venture capital firm committed to supporting the next generation of entrepreneurs.
We're back with season two of the Uncovered Podcast, where we are exploring the world of corporate development. I'm Matt Hayes, and I'm here with my co-host, Rob May.
Hi, everybody.
And we have Hillary Shirazi on from Zendesk. How are you doing today, Hillary?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Thank you for taking some time. And we're excited to talk to you about corporate development and all it has to offer. Why don't we kick it off by, you know, talking a bit about your background. You've had a great run in corporate development and, you know, you're now at Zendesk. But how about we go back a bit in your career and kind of talk a little bit about your career path and how you got to Zendesk and got into corporate development?
Yeah, for sure. So I'll start off by saying I have a what people consider now probably a traditional background in corp dev, a mix of investment banking and investing, whereas some larger companies, the folks probably have more legal backgrounds. But typically, if you look at what corp dev teams are looking for in job descriptions, it's a bit of that investment banking and investing, sometimes consulting. But I will say that background for me, it's a little bit accidental versus by design. I had no idea what corporate development was up until a few months before actually starting my first role. So one thing I do like to say, though, is that it's more about skills, not the roles. I think limiting corporate development roles to folks that have those specific investment banking and investing backgrounds isn't what necessarily is the best background. It's more about kind of three skills: a solid foundation in Excel, the ability to get smart on a new space, and also kind of a solid ability to build relationships and trust both externally with entrepreneurs and also internally with the various product stakeholders. So that's kind of the typical skills for someone in corp dev these days, I would say. So I started at Credit Suisse Investment Banking in New York after graduating from Wharton undergrad, and learned all the things I guess people would typically assume that you learn, kind of how to use Excel in your sleep without a mouse, things like that. But was on global energy, and so that was a lot of regulated utilities. We took some solar companies public and did project finance, tax equity flip structures. So kind of not super technologically advanced things. And I was looking at what was going on out on the West Coast, and I saw, you know, Facebook, it was growing. It, you know, bought this tiny team for $1 billion. That was Instagram at the time. And I thought to myself, you know, what is West Coast technology boom going on at this time? And so I kind of asked my friend who is at a tech firm, Silver Lake at the time. I was like, what's SaaS? Like, what is it, you know, what does it actually stand for? That was kind of how little I knew. And so from there, I decided to move out to the West Coast, landed at Spectrum Equity, which is growth equity focused. They do kind of internet and software. And I remember actually at the time, one of the interview questions was, hey, would you invest in Facebook? And at the time, it was trading around $20 a share, down from its IPO price of 38. And they said, you know, is it a good buy? What are your thoughts? And I very enthusiastically said, you know, yes, you should probably buy some stock there. And so, you know, luckily I got the job, but I did not buy shares in Facebook, which I kind of regret now. But the job was great, kind of first taste in tech, I would say. And kind of linking this now to corp dev, they do a lot more work with their portfolio companies, kind of writing bigger checks into fewer companies. And so got to spend some time working with one of the corporate development leads at a portfolio company and kind of pitched M&A deals and helped her think through strategy. And she said, hey, you should really think about doing, you know, corporate development as, you know, as a job if you like this. And so From there, she introduced me to a few different corp dev folks in the Valley, and one of them was Emily Choi, who was running LinkedIn corporate development at the time. She's now COO of Coinbase, but got to join that team when it was around five people. LinkedIn itself was around 5,000 people, and kind of got to learn all of the best practices from building out a really solid corp dev function. And across LinkedIn, worked on kind of a very small, you know, three person, I guess, kind of acquisition acquihire, all the way through to lynda.com, which was still LinkedIn's largest acquisition to date, $1.5 billion, 700 employees, and kind of spent 9 months helping integrate that into LinkedIn. And then fast forward, we actually announced another acquisition I worked on the day that, I don't know if anyone remembers this, but there was a pretty big drop in our stock price. And then 6 months later, fast forward, Microsoft then announced they were acquiring. So have kind of lived through that, both acquiring companies and being acquired. And that continues to go really well for them.
Hillary, what was it like, you know, being acquired? You know, you're in a corp dev function and you're getting acquired. That's a really interesting viewpoint. I'm sure people would love to hear about. What did that look like? What was your part in that?
Yeah. So I would say the general corp dev team at LinkedIn wasn't involved very much. I would say the head of the group was. But what's interesting is it was this huge acquisition. It didn't leak. They involved very, very, very few people. And so the way I kind of put it is, well, when we're acquiring a company, we don't necessarily kind of ask their corp dev team, hey, how should we do this? It's a lot more of the kind of target asking questions and less, I would say, legwork from the, you know, corp dev team that's being acquired. And they did a really good job of keeping the list of people that knew that small. And it wasn't until the day of announcement that the majority of the company found out about it.
It's very cool.
Interesting. So Hillary, can you walk us through a little bit, like these corp dev groups that we talk to are structured very differently. And I think it's important for like entrepreneurs listening to the podcast to understand, you know, that every corp dev group doesn't work the same. So, you know, can you walk us through the org structure a little bit at Zendesk? Like, you know, does corp dev roll up directly to the CEO, to legal? Is business development and partnerships under your group? Is it investment? Is it acquisition? Like, what does it look like?
Yeah. Great question. And the short answer is it's definitely different depending on the company. And I would say that's a lot due to size as well. So at Zendesk, we roll up into the chief legal officer, and alliances, which is our kind of business development and legal, also roll up under the chief legal officer. At LinkedIn, we rolled up under the CFO. So I think it's probably more traditional to have corporate development, or maybe not more traditional, but more common to have corp dev under finance, but it's definitely not always the case. And I think legal does make a lot of sense because we, you know, work very closely with the legal team on all the deals. So, from a structure point, I really do like the way they do it at Zendesk. And I would say also, you know, we sit next to alliances, but we don't, you know, do any of the alliances work. But it's nice because we can, you know, if an entrepreneur wants an intro, the team knows, you know, who to intro them to and how to have both the partnership and the M&A discussion, which is really helpful.
We spoke earlier a little bit about how, you know, you mentioned building relationships, and how much of corp dev is kind of like hunting for opportunities versus fielding inbound opportunities. And what does that look like? And how does that set up?
Yeah. So the way I like to think about it is kind of a funnel with three stages. So there's like top of the funnel, which is where all of the external opportunities kind of come in, and corp dev acts as a bit of a filter there. And so I would say that's 25% inbound and maybe 75% where we go out and kind of reach out to the company. And that's everything from just introductions from VCs, introductions from bankers, meeting folks at conferences, although that doesn't happen so much anymore. And also a lot of just corporate development, putting together a landscape kind of on a new market that they're working on in partnership with a product lead. And they'll say, okay, this is interesting. Let's go meet with a few entrepreneurs in the space and kind of get a little bit smarter on it. But again, very high level, very top of funnel, more relationship building. And then the middle of the funnel is where I would say we bring one of the folks that came in kind of through the top of the funnel in to meet with some of those product leaders or engineering leaders, where they actually start to meet more of the folks in the company. And I would say that's probably 10% inbound at that point. Because if you think about it, we are really excited about what's on our product roadmap and what we're looking at that point in time. And it's just harder for kind of folks outside to know what the right thing is at the right time. And so I think it's just more of a what's right for us right now. And then when you get to the bottom of the funnel, that's when, okay, we're gonna transact on a deal. We're going to, buy this company. And at that point, I would say the percent of companies kind of that were inbound versus that we source is much lower. So kind of not a lot of banker run processes, but again, not necessarily because of quality, more because kind of we are the only folks who know what the company needs at that time. And so we go out and we find that.
And do you feel like, so, you know, as you think about a startup that aspires to get acquired by a Zendesk or a large, you know, a large company, do you feel like it makes a lot of sense to start having a dialogue really early on in the company's life? Or do you feel like, does that have any impact? Like, what would your recommendation be for a startup? You know, do you start these relationships really early so that you have, you know, warm touch points? Or do you feel like it's more favorable to start them later on?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I've never actually thought about kind of how early should you be in starting these. And I think what I like to say is engage early. And that's not necessarily, you know, with corp dev. I would think about corp dev as, you know, if you don't know who on the product side or the engineering side to connect with, corp dev can help you do that. So you should definitely feel good about reaching out to corp dev and just kind of introducing yourself, putting yourself on their radar, and then also asking, hey, who in product should I be talking to? Because at the end of the day, a deal gets done when a product person is really passionate about kind of buying this company, the visions are aligned, they feel like it fits in with the roadmap. And again, corp dev's not going to be able to, make that argument. They're the ones who do, you know, move the deal across the finish line and get everything in order internally. But ultimately, it's really building that product relationship. And so I would say, use corp dev to get that intro, check in periodically, but don't waste a ton of time on it, because it's, you know, if a deal's not going to happen for a while, it should just be about kind of showing that your visions are aligned and that you're executing against your plan and kind of building that groundwork of they know that you're, you know, great and reliable and you align with what they're trying to do.
So Hillary, when I was an entrepreneur, so you and I met back when I was doing Backupify, my first company, and that company was an example of, if I look at the acquisition path of that, I mean, I had a dozen different people reach out to me over the years and say, hey, you know, we might be interested in acquiring you guys. We want to talk, you know, and that whittled down into, you know, two or three, serious conversations. But one of the things that surprised me was there were a couple of times where we got a verbal, like, hey, we're going to make you guys an offer. We're going to acquire you. And it still didn't happen, right? It didn't translate to a formal LOI. And so I think entrepreneurs get really excited when they start to build relationships with, you know, bigger companies like Zendesk is, and because they think, oh, like these guys want to acquire me, and you know, it's actually these deals they fall apart for a lot of reasons, even sort of post LOI. But even from that time, you start the process and you start digging in, and you start to realize, like, you know, it's not a fit, and there's a lot of different reasons for that. And so I caution entrepreneurs not to get too excited when they get their first sort of, you know, volley of, hey, we might want to acquire a company. But I'm interested in your perspective, having looked at this from the investment side and the corp dev side, like, what are some of the common things you see that cause deals to fall apart? Like maybe particularly some of the avoidable ones.
Yeah, I think this is something that's important that I think maybe not enough people talk about. And I have been, I'm close with people whose deals I've seen fall apart, and it's terrible. And it's not something, you know, you want to have happen. And again, that's kind of post-term sheet. And I think it's important to divide up the world kind of pre-term sheet, post-term sheet. How should entrepreneurs think about all of that? But I would say it's definitely a tight, like a tightrope to walk, because on the one hand, if you don't engage, you won't get bought because they're not going to know anything about you. And so it's not like, you know, corp dev backs a truck with money up and dumps it and says, hey, we're going to acquire you. It's again, that long relationship building, vision alignment, proof of execution and things like that. So how do you really do that without giving up too much, you know, information? And what I would say is with corp dev, it's funny because it's corp dev is actually, I would say the group that you should quote unquote worry about the least. I mean, we're not the ones, you know, building the product or necessarily taught like structuring the roadmap. But it seems like founders are kind of more open with sharing with the product folks, which are, you know, ultimately when people are worried about information kind of getting used, you know, product roadmap is, I think, what you want to actually be the most careful about. So I would say, if I were to give advice to an entrepreneur in terms of, okay, how do you balance that? I would say you want to share enough to get them excited and basically help educate them on why they shouldn't build this on their own, right? And why you have really spent the last, call it, few years finding all the dead ends and banging your head against the wall and really figuring out what it is that is needed in this market. And that's kind of your product. And so I think if you can, the best thing to do is kind of educate them on that. And again, like revealing numbers and growth rates and things like that, I actually don't think is that risky necessarily to reveal. It's more of kind of the secret sauce, as it were. And so I think, you know, just making sure that anything that we tell the team, you know, that we definitely wouldn't want to end up, you know, in their hands. So definitely don't share that. And I think a good way to preface these meetings, I always say, hey, we're going to ask a bunch of questions. Please feel free to take a pass if there's anything you feel uncomfortable with. And just like being very transparent and open that both sides are going to ask what they feel comfortable with and answer what they feel comfortable with. So I think that's important. But to get back to kind of the deals fall apart question, pre-term sheet, I think the key there is, again, everything I just said, but only bring in kind of a few people. You know, don't get too excited. Treat it as you would any partnership or, you know, business deal. Like it could happen, it could not. And you, again, you want to give them, you know, as much information as makes sense before signing, you know, any legal documents. And so I think if things fall apart, then again, it's disappointing, but, you know, ideally you haven't brought your whole team over the line and you can kind of keep operating the business as you would normally. I think where it gets really dicey is, as you mentioned, that deal falling apart after this letter of intent is issued. I've actually never been part of a deal where the deal fell apart after the letter of intent was issued. And I think a part of that is that just I've been fortunate to work with highly disciplined and highly ethical teams. And really the belief is that the only reason a deal should fall apart is if, you know, you uncover something in diligence that's a huge red flag, like fraud or litigation or something of that nature that you uncover. But really, again, this goes back to kind of the tightrope. There shouldn't be anything surprising that a company finds post letter of intent. And so you want to be able to, you know, make sure you're sharing pre-term sheet without sharing too much, because you just don't want anything to surprise anyone after that term sheet gets issued. And my only last point is that, again, kind of not all corp dev teams are created equal. Again, I would say I've been lucky that the ones I've worked with would never issue a term sheet unless they were very certain to kind of getting to close. And again, that creates more legwork pre-term sheet. But I have heard of some teams and the operating model of some folks is to kind of send a term sheet, get information, and then decide. And so I think, you know, that's unfortunate. But at the end of the day, maybe just push the founders to really make sure, you know, hey, is this real? Maybe ask them how many term sheets they've walked away from. Probably a whole nother topic, but having the founders, you know, push back in a way and make sure they're getting all the information up front.
Hillary, founders often talk to us a lot about kind of like exit levels. So like $100 million, $200 million. And, you know, you kind of go up the stack and everyone wants to be a multi-billion dollar company at this point. But I think what founders fail to realize is how much smaller your exit options get as you get larger. You know, for someone being on kind of like the corp dev side for almost 7 years now, you know, talk to us a little bit about deal sizes that you see get done and how common it is to see, you know, 250 million plus sized acquisitions versus smaller ones, and kind of like your vantage point from the inside. When does a deal start to get, you know, really large, kind of in your view? And you've worked at companies of different sizes, so I'm curious if that just depends on, you know, the size of the organization that you're at the time, or if there's kind of like a number where you start to feel that it's getting really large. And, you know, we'd love to just get an idea around that.
Yeah, great question. And I think, you know, of course, as you get bigger and bigger, just the realm of companies that can acquire you does get smaller. But I would also say that part of the reason there probably, you know, aren't a ton of these large acquisitions is a lot of companies, frankly, don't make it to that point and kind of can't be that successful independently. And I mean, it's hard, right, to reach a certain level of ARR. Yeah. It's just rarefied air once you're getting up there. But I would say that, you know, if you truly think, hey, I could raise this round, but I don't see our path to being more valuable than that, then I would definitely say probably pursue the M&A path. But if you do think, you know, hey, the opportunity set is large and I want to go at it that way, I think VCs would probably also push entrepreneurs to go in that direction, kind of go big or go home. But I would say, you know, M&A processes take a really long time. So if it's kind of between raising money or pursuing the acquisition path, I would say, again, that start the relationships with corp dev early and also understand that an M&A process, you know, takes a minimum of, call it, you know, 45 days, that's exclusivity, right? It usually gets extended. So call it 60 days. I think that's generally longer than it would take to close a round, and you have to have, you know, all the conviction up front there. So I think as long as people are thinking about it in advance, you should be evaluating those in parallel.
Gotcha. That was a great answer. And I think that's one that entrepreneurs really struggle with a lot, because there's so much push to go big and there's a limited number of market opportunities, you know, that they can actually do it. Well, Hillary, thank you so much for being on the podcast today. I think Matt and I both learned a lot. I think it'll be very, very helpful to the entrepreneurs and founders who are listening. For those of you listening to the podcast, if you have guests you'd like to see on the podcast, topics, questions, things we should cover, you can email us podcast@pjc.vc. We did a handful of these in the M&A season, so we hope if you like this, you'll go listen to the rest. And thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Uncovered Podcast. To learn more about PJC and the Uncovered Podcast, visit us at www.pjc.vc or email us at podcast@pjc.vc.